Good morning. Thank you all for coming today. It is now 10:07 a.m. on October 28th, 2019, and in accordance with the public notice issued by the Massachusetts Department of Energy Resources, the department hereby opens the public hearing on the proposed 2225 CMR 21 Clean Peak Energy Portfolio Standard or Clean Peak Regulations. This is the second of three public hearings that the department will conduct on the Clean Peak Regulations. As stated in the public notice, the proposed Clean Peak regulations address policy requirements pursuant to Mass General Laws, Chapter 25A, Section 17. The purpose of the public hearing is to receive verbal and written testimony on the proposed Clean Peak regulations. As indicated in the public notice, written testimony is accepted until 5 p.m. on October 30th, 2019, for the proposed Clean Peak regulations. This public hearing is being recorded and will be posted on the department's website. The department requests that, to the extent possible, parties also submit written comments of their testimony. It is the department's practice to recognize any public official wishing to provide verbal or written testimony and allow them to proceed at the beginning of the hearing. If there's any elected officials present today, please come forward at this time and be recognized. Okay. Sure.
Not to get up and speak, but just to be identified, John Ward, Gill Select Board Chair.
Great, thank you.
For the same purposes, Karen Rivero, Pelham Select Board Chair.
Thank you. Okay, so now we're going to go in order on the sign-up sheet. So we've had five people sign in. And then once we go through the list, if there's anyone else who would like to speak, they can do so at that time. And then we're going to close the hearing at noon, whichever, if you guys are done and want to stay, that's fine. I'm here till noon, so if people come in, you know, that's what we've advertised that we'll be here for. So, yes.
What is going to be done to record the statements?
I have a digital recorder here, and so each time after the public hearing, those get posted to the website either within a day or two. So, yes, thank you. Okay, up first, Rosemary Wessel, please.
My name is Rosemary Wessel. I'm with Berkshire Environmental Action Team, and we strongly oppose to the definition of clean being used by DOER when talking about clean energy. With the Global Warming Solutions Act in place as state law, and with a stern warning from the IPCC that we only have about a decade to drastically cut our emissions, it is long past time to stop using combustible fuels. It's not acceptable for DOER to classify biomass or waste-to-energy incineration or other fuel-based electric generation as clean energy for seasonal peak shaving purposes or for other regulatory considerations such as redefining the RPS. Biomass and trash incineration plants, such as the proposed plant in Palmer in East Springfield, have emissions that include PM2.5 fine particulates and nitrogen oxides. With the Clean Peak standard relying on the department's definition of the RPS, it's entirely within the realm of possibility that these fuel combustion sources for electric generation would receive further incentives, putting already overburdened environmental justice communities in the crosshairs for further local pollution and for our climate at greater risk due to greenhouse gas emissions. It's also especially important for seasonal peak generation to be from clean sources because at times of peak energy use, our current portfolio of energy generation plants is already producing a full load of emissions. And during winter peak, emissions from thermal generation loads such as gas, oil, and wood heat for residential and other thermal uses are also added to the mix. The unavailability of DOE guidelines. The draft regulation refers to several guidelines that have not been published by DOER. Without full access to information on what these guidelines are, such as the Guideline for Clean Peak Resource Eligibility, Guideline on Demand Response Resources, Guideline on Energy Reserves, and the Guideline on Distribution Circuit Multiplier, there is no way to fully and meaningfully comment on this draft regulation. These need to be published by DOAR before asking for final comments. We ask for the comment period to be extended. Until complete guidelines are referred to in the draft regulations are published, it's not fair to set a deadline for comments. Once DOAR publishes these guidelines, the comment period deadline should be established 60 days after that date. In theory, the concept of a clean peak energy standard could be a brilliant step toward boasting a move to an all-clean renewable grid, but avoiding fossil fuel generation sources is not enough if other fuel-based sources are to be considered. Since this is being touted by DOAR as a first-in-the-nation proposal, we should make sure to get it right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next up, we have Glenn Ayers.
Okay. Thanks. My name is Glenn Ayers. I'm a public, long-time public health, public civil servant, I guess you could say, although I'm partially retired now, thank God. And the first thing I want to say is that I have a general problem with the way DOER writes regulations, and Rosemary alluded to this. To me, these regulations are very similar to the APS regulations and the RPS regulations. They're connected, obviously, and they're a complete abuse of discretion on the part of DOER in that, as was pointed out, they rely on guidelines for a huge part of the regulatory framework. And those regulations that rely on guidelines do that intentionally to remove them from the 30A process so that these so-called regulations can be revised at the whim of the agency, and that's an abuse of discretion. Guidelines are intended to explain the regulatory program to people who may not understand it because of the complexity. They're not intended to take the place of regulations as this set of regulations, 225 CMR 21, refer to guidelines that, as was pointed out, have not even been released for comment. And so that creates a framework that frustrates the intent of a regulatory program. And it's an abuse of discretion. And it should be challenged legally. And it will be challenged administratively if these regulations are released. They'll be appealed for that reason. There's over 18 references to guidelines throughout the however many pages, 12 pages of regulations or 15 pages, whatever it is. And that's wrong. That's the wrong way to write regulations. I've been reviewing regulations and working with complex federal and state regulations since 1980, and I understand what DOER is doing here, and it's an abuse of discretion. So the next point, which was also made, and I'm just going to reinforce it, is that this is not a clean peak standard. This includes a potential dirty peak standard, because it includes a link to the RPS and the APS, which includes combustion sources. So it's dirty. Biomass, burning garbage, the dirtiest source of energy there is, and it's wrong. It's morally wrong to call this clean peak. It's wrong to use that word. It's a type of deception. It's based on subterfuge, misdirection, misinformation. It's like saying toxic sludge is good for you. And that's a book that maybe DOER needs to read, or maybe they've read, and they're implementing the concepts in that book. Because that's what this is. This is a way of lying to the public that, look, we're doing something good. But hidden within this, like a Trojan horse, is combustion technology that impacts public health. And everyone knows that. There's no question about that. Another problem with this peak standard is the implementation over a 30-year period. We do not have 30 years to implement a program like this. We need to have reduced our carbon emissions to net zero by 2025, if we have any hope of turning things around. So a 10-year implementation period to meet 9%, or what, 6 years to meet 9%, we should be net zero in 6 years, in 5 years. So again, the implementation of this is too slow. The phasing out of the program during a 30-year period makes essentially no sense. It should be increasing and not decreasing over that time period. That seems backwards to me. And the public health impacts of this proposal need to be fully disclosed up front, in advance, in order for us to, in order for the public to understand this program, and in order for the rulemaking process to be honest. So how many additional deaths are associated with implementing this subterfuge, if you understand what I'm saying, this hidden process of including the dirtiest energy sources in a clean, so-called clean standard? What's the impact on morbidity? The homework needs to be done. That information is readily available. Plenty of studies will indicate what the likely impact of this will be on the population. And that needs to be disclosed up front so that an informed decision can be made. And this really needs to go through a public health process, these regulations. The Public Health Council, the Department of Public Health, this is a program that affects public health across the Commonwealth. And there needs to be professional review by people that understand public health. And I'm not happy with the way things have been running at DOER, obviously. I'm a critic of the programs that have been coming out of DOER under the Baker administration. I think that these regulations need to comply with the Global Warming Solutions Act, Section 3D. There needs to be an analysis that shows how this regulatory program complies with the requirement for an annual aggregate decrease in greenhouse gas emissions. If you're including dirty carbon-emitting sources in this regulatory program through linking it to the RPS and APS, then it must comply. Regulations must comply with the Global Warming Solutions Act mandate to reduce greenhouse gas emissions on an annual basis. So I think that these regulations, while there may be a good intention underlying them, I think that the way they're written now, they are an abuse, and they need to be rewritten, and they need to be fully transparent without referring to a whole bunch of guidelines that no one has seen, and studies that have not been done that disclose the probable impacts to public health. Thank you, and I'll submit written comments.
Great, thank you. Okay, next up we have Claire Chang.
So, I completely agree with Glenn and Rosemary. There's absolutely no need for biomass to be included in a clean peak standard. My focus, though, is more on the solar side and the storage side. I haven't actually read the 12 pages. I was actually hoping for a little summary today because we're totally small. But anyway, given the lead-in that Glenn has provided, there absolutely has to be a light-speed action on getting solar and storage implemented in the state of Massachusetts. We don't have any time to mess around anymore with trying to placate the utilities or the stakeholders on their behalf. We can't provide them with a platform to basically slow down and bottleneck interconnections for both storage and solar. we need at least 4 gigawatts of solar a year in order to make progress on both the Global Warming Solutions Act and actually 100% renewable by anything reasonable. 100% by 2050 would be nice, but we actually need 100% by 2030. That's what's realistic. And we're not going to get there at the pace, the 400 megawatts of solar that we're doing right now. So we need to push that. And I was hoping that the Clean Peak Standard was going to allow part of that to happen in terms of incentives or other mechanisms for promoting either implementation of solar PV systems, actually could include solar thermal as well, and also storage. So the utilities up until this point have used interconnections and net metering to throttle back the amount of solar that has been installed in the state of Massachusetts. So that whole mechanism needs to be reformed. The DPU is looking at certain parts of that with docket 1955, but it's not fast enough. At the time the DPU opened docket 1955, there was an opportunity to move at a very fast pace to open up the interconnection tariff and to make it possible for solar PV and utilities, the installers and the developers, to work with the utilities on a really companionable level. That, I think, has broken down to a degree, especially with these cluster studies, which initiated some of the DPU's concerns. So I do not know what mechanism, and I do not know what solutions to give DOER in terms of working with the DPU. I understand that they're both separate, siloed agencies, but we've got to figure out how to get past, well, one, Governor Baker, two, the Speaker of the House, three, the utilities, and move solar, wind included, into this whole process so that we can move at light speed to get all of these conversions and transformations happening now. The other problem that's going to happen that I don't know if the Clean Peak Standard is addressing is that as soon as we start electrifying everything, especially transportation and heating, our demand peak is going to shift from summer to winter. Unfortunately, solar doesn't have a larger generation capacity in the winter. So we're going to need storage on a massive scale in order to overcome or to have any chance of reducing that winter peak load from heating. And there are all of the technology is on the shelf. It's available now. We don't have to wait for some silver bullet. So it's just the financial opportunity and other considerations that we need to take into account to make sure that storage has that avenue, has that runway to get going instead of the solar coaster that we've been dealing with for the last 15 years. Now, the ITC, I understand, is going to possibly include storage as a standalone in the extension that we're looking at, but as we all know, Congress is moving so fast that I'm not going to put any bets on that, but the Clean Peak Standard needs to take storage into account and figure out how to make demand response work. And so I don't actually know what the tie-in is with demand response, the RPS, the SMART program, and then the Clean Peak Standard. How those pieces all fit together in order to move storage forward so that the utilities can also benefit as well as residential and commercial systems. And I think that's mostly what I wanted to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So next,
is there some place that we're supposed to sign up?
Yeah.
Thanks.
So next we have Logan Malik.
Logan Malik, and I'm with No Fracked Gas in Mass. And I just wanted to first start by restating some of the stuff that Glenn said. It's absolutely critical. There's a significant evidence that as of now we are not adhering and we're not on track to meet our GWSA goals, the goals that were listed in the Global Warming Solutions Act. And it is absolutely critical that in every single policy that DOER and any other agency is implementing, that a thorough study be done about how this will impact our goals. So I just wanted to restate that. I also wanted to, again, voice our strong opposition to any new incentives for biomass power generation, particularly through something like the Clean Peak Energy Standard. I think it's very clear that the purpose of this law is to support cost-effective reductions in greenhouse gas emissions during the periods of peak energy use, and in reality, biomass power plants, they're expensive, they generate net CO2 pollution, more net CO2 pollution than fossil fuel power plants per megawatt hour of energy produced, and they emit disproportionately large amounts of air pollution. So this appears to be a source of energy that is exactly what the Clean Peak Standard is trying to prevent. And I think that for that reason, it should be removed in some capacity. I recognize it's attached to the RPS and the APS, but it should be removed from this proposal, and biomass should not be considered a clean source of energy.
Thank you. So next we have Ken Kippen.
I'm here representing PATE, which is People Against Toxic Effluents in Ashfield, Mass. And I'm here to advocate against regulations that would include wood-burning biomass power plants and waste-to-energy garbage incinerators. I'm shortening my statement due to my throat condition. We support the statements already made by Rosemary of Beat, Glenn Ayers, and Claire Chang regarding an abuse of discretion and calling it Clean Peak when it impacts public health. And that's my foreclosed statement.
Thank you. Next, we have Todd Alinsky-Paul.
Thanks. I'm Todd Alinsky-Paul. I'm here representing Clean Energy Group from Vermont. They're a nonprofit. We do a lot of work with state energy offices and agencies, including a lot of work in Massachusetts, and I focus on energy storage, and that's why I'm here. Just a few things I wanted to say. For one thing, I don't know if DOER or anybody or any of the consultants have done the calculation on whether the Clean Peak Standard is expected to help the state meet its energy storage goals. But I think that that's something that should be done and should be made public. DOER was clearly given authority by the legislators in the state to set a procurement mandate to meet energy storage deployment goals, 200 megawatt hours by January 1st and 1,000 megawatt hours by 2025. DOER hasn't done that. Instead, they seem to be focusing on this Clean Peak Standard as a vehicle to get storage deployed. And I don't have any idea, and I don't know if anyone else has any idea, whether you would expect to meet these targets just through the Clean Peak Standard. So I'd like to get that information. I would encourage DOER to make that public. What is expected to be deployed in storage in the state under the CPS. Secondly, there doesn't appear to be any kind of carve-out or adder to encourage distributed or customer third-party owned energy storage under the Clean Peak Standard. This is something that California got right when they did their storage mandate. They said that utilities had to procure a certain amount of storage on the transmission system, a certain amount on the distribution system, a certain amount behind customer meters. And that as a result, you see that there is a lot of behind the meter solar and storage deployed in California. If you don't have this any kind of requirement to put the storage in different places on the system, we don't know what we're going to end up with. And it would be nice if customers were able to enjoy some of the benefits, such as resiliency and cost savings, in addition to helping the state to meet the CPS goals. Thirdly, there is a resilience multiplier in the proposed regulations of 1.5. I'm doubtful as to whether that's sufficient. Resilience is a very valuable benefit that you get from these, from solar and storage behind the meter, if you encourage it and or require it. But a 1.5 multiplier may not be sufficient to overcome additional costs associated with resilience. And as we all saw in Superstorm Sandy, resilience is incredibly valuable. It provides a lot of social benefits, especially at critical facilities. Another point, I don't see any kind of low-income multipliers or carve-outs in the proposed regulation. I feel this is a lost opportunity. Low-income communities should not be left behind in the energy revolution that we're entering right now. And there's no reason that you can't do this. This is something else California did. There's an equity budget in their self-generation incentive program. There is a carve-out in their utility mandate. You encourage and enable storage and solar to be located in low-income neighborhoods where people are most in need of cost savings and resilience. So I think that should be added to the CPS. In regards to behind-the-meter storage in general, it seems as though it's supposed to participate as demand response. The demand response guidelines don't seem to be out, at least I haven't seen them. There's a note that says they're going to be forthcoming. I think this is really important. It's incumbent upon DOER to make those regulations public so that everybody can understand how behind-the-meter systems are supposed to participate. There's a lot of detail in that, which will determine, for example, whether the attributes of behind-the-meter systems reside with the customer or the utility. In net metering, for example, if you have behind-the-meter solar, the utility gets to take the capacity benefits and sell them into the capacity market. In fact, they don't. They sit on them, but they could. Now we have recently a docket that says if you install storage behind the meter along with solar and you have a net metering contract, you have an opportunity to buy back the storage capacity and use it or sell it as you see fit. That's the kind of detail that we need to see in terms of behind the meter systems, how they'll participate and who owns the attributes. And that's something I'd like to see be made clear. Regarding the alternative compliance price of $30, it's supposed to be $30 through 2029 and then start to decline after that, $30 per megawatt hour. My question is whether that's sufficient to drive deployment. It serves as a price ceiling, and nobody's going to pay more than that if that's the ACP payment. So, the question is whether that's going to be sufficient to meet the goals, and also, is there any kind of price floor needed? I'd like also to ask the DOER clarify whether customers can participate through aggregation. What's the position of aggregators such as Sunrun, who recently sold aggregated behind-the-meter capacity into the capacity market? Will they be able to participate and market this clean peak standard to their customers? Aggregate the resource and then sell it into the system. And finally, I would just ask whether the 25% size requirement for storage might be relaxed for residential participation. There's a requirement that the storage capacity be at least 25% of the associated solar capacity. That makes sense for large systems. I'm not sure that makes sense for a residential system, where that may be more storage than you need. And I don't quite understand what the requirement is about in that case, since you'd be aggregating those systems in any case. And that's it, thank you.
Thank you. Up next, we have Janet Sinclair.
Yes, hi, I'm sorry I missed Glenn's comments because I might be repeating some of what he said, but just in terms of having biomass in the RPS or the APS or however this would be included in this program, the recent DOER studies that got done, especially some of the ones that we saw, that was a health study done by UMass, but paid for by DOER, and also what I'm looking at is when you're doing your studies, I just feel like you have industry insiders doing these studies on CO2 impacts and health impacts on biomass in particular. I mean, it's just so egregious to me. You know, it's really almost immoral to do it that way. And the other thing is, with the biomass in particular and related to the Global Warming Solutions Act, you know, burning biomass isn't just about emissions, it's also about forest impacts. And what we know, from looking around everywhere, is that whole trees are being harvested, not just tops or just waste wood or whatever you call that. So in terms of like how eligible fuels are defined, both in the APS and the RPS, what happens is that we went to one of your workshops, so we really heard this firsthand, I think everybody here should hear it too, is that when eligible biomass cut gets done, apparently DCR is going to go out and actually look at that woodlot and say whether or not these standards were met, meaning leaving a certain amount on the ground and all that. But the reality is the day afterwards, that same exact woodlot could be just clear cut, and no one will ever know it, and no one will care, and no one will ever go look at it. The only time that it would be looked at again is if that same piece of land was going to be then used again for an eligible fuel, which would probably never happen. The other thing that we found with the RPS, because we did a records request for the logging jobs that did qualify for the RPS while you still had, we were still paying people in Maine and New Hampshire, maybe Vermont, to burn wood using our money. And what we found when we looked at the actual forest jobs that were done that was supposedly eligible fuel, all it was a list, and it didn't even list the properties. It barely listed anything. And these were the reports that were sent in to you, to DOER. You had no way of knowing anything about what happened on any of those properties, barely knew where they were. You knew nothing at all about where that forest product came from. And then the last thing I want to just talk about is this, that if we're not just, with biomass, we can't be just talking about emissions. We have to be talking about carbon sequestering. There's just nothing, and we talk about energy storage, we should be talking about carbon storage in our forests. You know, instead of DOER paying people to burn wood and call it clean energy and pollute our air and destroy the public's health, we should be, DOER should have a program that pays people to maximize carbon sequestering on private land and on public land. And you should be paying for that side of the equation. And right now, all you're paying attention to you're paying attention to biomass in such a way that it's almost like, I don't even know how you can do any of it with a straight face, frankly. Thank you.
Up next, we have Gia Neswald.
Hi. I live in Turner's Falls, and I'm a member of Wendell State Forest Alliance. I want to reiterate everything Janet just said. And really don't have anything new to add, but just want to say that incineration of any kind does not belong under any heading with the words clean energy in it. And they need to be explicitly excluded from this legislation. Apart from that, just that we can't properly comment on guidelines that haven't been released. We need to see storage and resource eligibility guidelines, and then we need to be given 60 to 90 days to study and comment. So looking for an extension on the public input period. Thank you.
So we've concluded with the names on the list. Is there anyone else here who would like to comment? Okay.
Could I add?
I guess so, sure.
So I just reviewed some emails. So one of the issues is that there's a review of the standard only every 5 years. As we've seen with SMART, there needed to be a review within basically the first 24 hours. So there's a desperate need to tighten up these review processes where either the floor or the cap on these pricing mechanisms are reviewed at least annually, if not every 6 months. Because basically the marketplace does respond that fast, especially when it comes to storage. So that would be my recommendation, is to tighten up those standards for review.
Thank you. Anyone else want to comment?
Yeah, I have one additional thing as well. With regard to ownership of energy storage, Massachusetts legislatively granted utilities an unrestricted right to own energy storage, where they aren't allowed to own generation. And it's potentially very problematic because anyone who wants to install storage needs to deal with utilities for interconnection at the very least. And so utilities are gatekeepers, and to give them an unrestricted ownership allowance for storage really opens the door for a monopoly situation where you can't compete as a third party with the utility, in that they have enormous resources, rate base, guaranteed rate of return, and they control interconnection and rates and so forth. It would be, the CPS really is an opportunity for the state to take a step in the direction of correcting this by having some kind of requirement that utilities don't end up owning all the storage or all the resources within CPS. And mm-hmm. So while it won't change the legislation, it could, within this program, ensure that third parties and customers have some ownership of energy storage, qualifying energy storage, that would help to ensure a more diverse marketplace in the state for storage, and we would like to see that.
Anybody else? Okay. Seth. Yes.
Karen Rivero. I am on the commercial design and sales team at PV Squared Solar and the chair of the select board in Pelham. And I would just like to urge the DOER to engage with the environmental leaders that are present in this room that are giving testimony. They're not paid by any organization to do the research that they have done to present today. I think it's really critical, and to create some kind of a think tank that is engaging with this knowledge to solve this problem.
Thank you. Did you want to add to your?
Yeah, I had some secondary comments, largely sparked by Todd's most recent comments. We submitted comments on the SMART application as well, that there should be incentives for what are currently brownfield-type buildings or abandoned buildings. I'm thinking of places like Berkshire Mall, for instance, has recently closed except for the Target store. There are 12 acres of roof there and a building that could house lots of storage. And there needs, if we're going to be serious about really implementing as much storage and clean peak generation, there should be incentives for properties like that to be used. So we're not considering forest land or farmland. We're taking what's already brownfield first and changing that into clean peak generation and storage.
Thank you.
I would like to follow up on that. My name is John Ward. I want to make sure that I'm not speaking as a municipal official at this point. I'd like to follow up on what Todd said and what Rosemary said and give a shining example of a case in point for Todd, which is the policy of Eversource at this point to add inverter capacity for AC coupled systems to the inverter capacity for the grid tied systems, which gives a very clear financial disincentive for behind the meter storage, where adding the two inverter capacities pushes people out of the net metering exemption and makes residential storage not financially viable. And that seems to me to be in clear violation of what's in the tariff and in clear violation of what the intent is of doing any type of energy storage, whether it's behind the meter or in front of the meter, for the utilities to be given unlimited ability to install storage and yet providing financial disincentive to homeowners.
Thank you. Yes.
I also am interested in this whole solar, I call them solar forests. Living in a small town, what happens just because of the incentives for solar in general is that we know that some of our regional agencies probably are paid by DOE, are paid by the state to go around. And I was there when it happened in my town where somebody came and encouraged my town to change its bylaws so that it would be happy for green energy. And it was like a carte blanche kind of thing, like, yes, solar, yes, wind, yes, biomass, yes, 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 all across the board in our zoning. And of course, almost no one at that time knew what this all meant. And so what happened is that these towns, like right now, Wendell's going through it. I've also talked with people in other towns, Roe, my town, Buckland, Heath, I'm trying to think of where else I've spoken with recently, Belchertown. These are towns where what happens is a solar developer will come in and just, you know, run it, you know, powerhouse its way into these large solar facilities before that town has any idea what's going on. So right now, Wendell, I think in 2 days, is going to be voting on a moratorium on large-scale solar to protect itself. So the state basically encouraged this big vehicle for just an unremitted, there's just no way that the towns feel like they can handle it. And so now after a big solar project is proposed, and after the town feels like it can't say no, which they can, by the way, after that happens in a town, and after a town feels like it's been overpowered by you and moneyed interests, then they close the door. And this is after, you know, you might have a 50-acre clear cut in a forest, like I think it's Belchertown or right next to Belchertown. This is, you know, you just should not, you almost like shouldn't allow it. You should just say no whenever you cut a certain percentage of a solar project, a certain percentage of a forest land. Just should say no. And it should be go backwards too, so that somebody can't clear cut some land like what just happened, I think, in Conway. Oh, it's clear cut already, and now we're going to stick solar in. This has just been really a very difficult thing for our very small towns here.
So this is, it's not fair that the state helps these developers do this stuff. Thank you.
Thank you.
So can I counter Janet here for a second? So if a housing developer comes in and cuts 10 or 20 acres of forest, nobody says anything.
I'm just saying it's local zoning. I don't know if that's true. In my town, they
It's absolutely true.
Well, not in
so
my town.
It's absolutely true.
It's local
so
zoning.
So there are so many, so I agree that trees shouldn't be cut down. But
okay.
If a housing developer or any other strip mall or commercial entity wants to come in and cut trees down, there is no process by which that it does have to go through a site plan review through the planning board, but there isn't as much opposition, just put it that way, to someone who's going to be providing jobs and increasing the tax base of a town and all these other things that those developers would list. So unfortunately, I think we need to look at the bigger picture and basically just not cut trees down. So And there is also, because Boston and the environs have already cut all their trees down, they're not as sensitive or aware, or actually they think Western Mass is just off the chart, off the map, and it's not even in their psyche to think about. So it's unfortunate because people in Boston see Boston and they go, well, if you have to cut a few trees down, well, we've already cut a few trees down. We've in fact cut the whole place down. So what's the big deal if we have to cut a few trees down? So it's a very actually colonial empire kind of viewpoint is for Boston to say, well, you guys can cut 10 acres or you can cut 15 acres or 50 acres or whatever, because you've got 102,000 plus acres. But we actually shouldn't be cutting any trees down. And Boston actually should be covering every single parking lot and every single building. And it's still not going to be enough. I understand that it's not enough. But that should be happening first at a massive scale before you come out here and cut our trees down. And it's not happening in Boston. And I do understand that there are economic, aesthetic, structural, and all kinds of other reasons, but you need to make the economics work then in order for Boston and the big and Worcester and Springfield to be able to get on board and basically change the cityscape so that it is more self-resilient and self-reliant and sustainable itself, instead of depending on us to, just like the Quabbin, we bring you water, we bring you clean air, and we're going to bring you clean power. But at certain points, Boston needs to figure out how to take care of itself and not depend on us all the time.
This will be the last time I speak, I swear. But just to back up with what Claire said.
We're here till 12.
So yeah,
we're not going anywhere. So.
Every study I've seen on clean energy says that generation needs to be as close to the demand as possible. So yes, exhausting all of those places where the demand is highest in the eastern part of the state, on rooftops, on parking lots, on brownfields, needs to happen first. And just as an example of what the small towns are going through, as you were saying, Beckett received dozens of proposals from multinational solar companies to cut down large amounts of trees, and they're now wrestling with all of those proposals coming in at once. So this is a universal problem out in this part of the state where the demand is far lower. Thank you.
I would also like to draw a connection to the tree cutting program at Eversource. And it has gotten much more aggressive, instead of more responsive. They're now cutting back 15 feet from ground to sky within any power line. and they're making the case that it's to prevent, you know, tree, to prevent power loss, but there's lack of transparency with their full plan. They're coming to the town saying, we're going to cut the trees down and it's going to save you money, you won't have to do it yourself, to all the neighborhood, the neighbors on main roads. So they're like, oh, that's great. But they're also creating these, in my town, creating a huge swath of tree removal that has not been disclosed to the town. And I would like to make the connection between that and the Clean Peak standard, because I've been watching this in my town for quite some time, and the tree removal is creating quite a market for the state, and Eversource already has a basic, or utilities have an open free market, or they've been given a market without the responsibility for full transparency with the some of their business operations, and this is one of them.
Can I ask her a question? Just a clarification for what she just said. It's free for all.
It's fine.
Is this just like is this along the power lines, or is this like just everywhere where there's all roads and stuff all through town?
Well, it's just wherever the power lines are.
Do you mean power lines, or like just the city?